we're not looking at decolonizing so much as re-indigenizing. You know, we're not trying to move backwards. This is forward movement, and it's a healing in our communities, but it's part of moving forward and improving our lives.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experience and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. Montana isn't all cattle herds and fields of waving grain. This sprawling state is also full of food deserts, places without affordable, healthy food options. The lack of access to healthy food for residents of many of the state's Indian reservations contributes to some horrible demographic statistics. The life expectancy for Native American women is 62, a full 20 years less than for non-Native women. For Montana's Native American men, it's 56. One 27-year-old woman of Blackfeet and Cherokee heritage is on a mission to improve Native people's lives through healthy diet and a return of indigenous food systems. Mariah Gladstone grew up in Northwest Montana. She graduated from Columbia University with a degree in environmental engineering and returned home, where in 2016, she started IndigiKitchen, an online cooking site dedicated to re-indigenizing our diets. Using how-to videos and featuring foods native to the Americas, IndigiKitchen gives viewers recipes, instructions, and other tools to find and prepare food with historic connections to their own communities. Today on Can Do, we're learning about Mariah's journey back to Montana, her passion for Native cookery, and her determination to strengthen ties to Indigenous culture and community. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Mariah, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. Can you tell me a little bit about the genesis of IndigiKitchen and when the idea came to you?
I actually launched the idea for IndigiKitchen at a conference that I attended in Minneapolis while I was taking vacation days away from my railroad job. It was a food sovereignty conference, and I noticed that a lot of the conversation around food at that time in 2016 was still focused on access, on making sure that Native people have access to healthy, affordable foods, and that we're able to get those things within our communities. But because of this multi-generational disconnect, we know that restoring access by itself will not restore the diets of Native people. And so I was laughing and saying that we needed to start an Indigenous cooking show. And if no one was going to do it, then I would do it. And I would name it IndigiKitchen. And I was joking around with some folks, and someone said, "All right, Mariah, you go do that." And of course, then I had to. I launched IndigiKitchen. I figured out how to start recording videos using the janky camera setup I had and using free video editing software and jerry-rigging a tripod and starting to share the information that I had and collecting recipes from friends and continuing to expand that.
And what kind of work were you doing at the railroad when this idea came to you?
I was doing engineering management, actually. I ran a steel gang.
So you went to college for environmental studies and you're finishing your master's degree in environmental science. How does that reinforce your IndigiKitchen goals?
Yeah, my undergraduate degree is actually in environmental engineering. So I was really focused on sustainability and engineering technology, looking at tech solutions and thinking about how we connect with Indigenous principles to create more sustainable spaces. And of course, coming back home after college and just living with that reality of what being on a food desert means, not having access to fresh foods and really starting to think about the ways that my ancestors fed themselves helped me connect with some of that information. And then, of course, you know, even though I'm not directly doing engineering and I'm not doing green building design or alternative energy, I'm still very much thinking along the lines of sustainability principles and thinking of how to use Indigenous knowledge to restore our health and our well-being in the 21st century.
You're back living in Montana now, but growing up, how much time did you spend on the Blackfeet Reservation?
I spent my summers on the Blackfeet Reservation pretty much as long as I can remember, but I was raised over in Northwest Montana and attended school over in Kalispell.
I notice you're wearing a shirt that says strong, resilient, and Indigenous on it. So what does that mean to you?
There's kind of a joke within the Native community that the strong, resilient, Indigenous shirts are the live, laugh, love of Indian country. But of course, they are all words with a lot of significance to Native people. This survival of genocide, this continued presence, this ability to thrive in the face of past and continued trauma. And of course, Indigenous, this word in itself and our connection with our landscapes, our desire to be present in these spaces where our ancestors lived and thrived and where we have multi-millennia of history.
How important is it for the Native American population to return to Indigenous diets?
So I think it's important for everyone to obviously eat healthy, unprocessed, fresh foods, especially when they're available through local markets and through ecologically sound and sustainable harvesting practices. I think those are all principles that apply to everyone, whether Indigenous or not. For Native people, because of the history that we have on this continent, our food systems were very intentionally targeted by colonial governments, both in the US as well as Canada. And, you know, that took place in a variety of different ways. Obviously, our food systems were targeted through the destruction of bison populations, the burning of our crops and our fields and our storage facilities, and many, many other different ways. Of course, the damming of rivers affected different people. And so this shift within our diets has been very, very rapid and forced. It was the 1850 Commissioner of Indian Affairs report that wrote, "It is cheaper in the end to feed the whole flock for a year than to fight them for a week." Of course, referring to Native people and the desire to force us onto subsidized food systems to avoid military conflict. And so it has been through subsidized food systems, government rations, that control has been exerted on our populations. Food sovereignty is connected to our political sovereignty. And so by restoring fresh, healthy foods within our communities, we're able to restore that political sovereignty, that economic sustainability, but also our physical health, our well-being, and that presence on the land, that belonging.
So what is the difference between pre-contact food and the diets that most Native Americans are eating now on reservations?
So pre-contact food is a term that is used generally to represent any type of food that folks would have had access to prior to European contact. So for some folks, that was, of course, 1492 up through the 1800s is when the majority of Native folks had their first contact. And so when we look at traditional diets, they're high in protein, high in omega-3s, high in fiber, high in complex carbohydrates, and of course, fresh fruits, sometimes fresh vegetables. And of course, with the transition to subsidized diets, we see that transition to high carbohydrates, high processed foods, things designed to be shelf stable. Of course, you start seeing products like wheat flour, like dairy being incorporated, and of course, massive amounts of processed sugar. You also see things just like canned foods that have been packaged in syrup and other things of the sort. And so it's a massive dietary shift, but it's also a lot of products that we have had very little time for our bodies to adapt to digesting. So dairy products, for example, are something that Native people have only had a couple of generations to build those enzymes to digest. And so you'll see very high rates of lactose intolerance within Native communities.
You referenced in one of the articles I read about you that you had 12,000 years of Blackfeet history and ate a diet that was 90% protein. And now for only a couple of hundred years, you've had to switch to a different kind of diet as a result of food issues and food sovereignty issues. How do people on the reservation get their healthy diet complement when there's so few, resources? I know on some of the very large reservations, there may be only one or two grocery stores. How do you expect tribal members to get access to healthy foods?
So besides our ability to access foods in grocery stores, there are still many more ways that people obtain food. The term food deserts is obviously limited because it only defines the places where we're able to go and purchase food in supermarkets and not necessarily where we find food. Of course, on the Blackfeet Reservation, we still have a very rich hunting culture. We still have the ability to eat a lot of wild game, and that's still very common practice within this community. Our freezers are generally stocked with elk and deer and moose, if you're lucky enough to get a tag. But we have that. And of course, we have those lean proteins that are still incorporated within our diets. And then, of course, we also see a lot of our traditional plant foods that are still available. And when we reconnect with that knowledge, we're able to restore those things into our diets as well. People still go out berry picking, of course, but there's not the large scale preservation of foods that would have occurred typically. So while some people will go out and pick Sarvis berries every year, they're not dried in mass quantities like they traditionally would have been. And most people will eat them fresh or maybe bake them into a pie rather than dry them into pemmican or make them into some type of more lean protein snack where they would have been incorporated before. So there's still a lot of these plant foods and a lot of these animal foods that are accessible to folks. There's still ways that we can grow things. The problem is this disconnect of knowledge. And so while we work with folks, while we try to get fresh, affordable food into our grocery stores, we also have to restore this knowledge. Make sure that if we're planting community gardens, people know what to do with the food that's coming out of the community gardens. How do we prepare those things that we're able to grow and harvest and preserve them so that our families can eat healthy foods and recognize them and enjoy them?
How did you learn the recipes that you're sharing on your show?
I've learned the recipes that I share in a variety of ways. One of the main ways that I connect with recipes has been to contact Native chefs within the industry, to contact my friends. I remember the first recipe I ever shared on IndigiKitchen was actually a recipe that I called a college friend up and asked her for, because I remember she used to bring it to potlucks and study groups in college. And so I called her and asked her for this traditional Potawatomi recipe, and she sent me a newspaper clipping that had it on there. And so that's one of the ways that I help restore this knowledge. Another is to connect with elders. So when I'm doing really, really traditional recipes, I reach out to folks within the community that have experience preparing those things. And if the opportunity allows, to go out with them to harvest plants together, to butcher an animal together, or to cook together. Of course, that's been limited by COVID, but with folks getting vaccinated, we're hoping that we're able to go out and collect yampa or double root and balsam root and camas and do a camas bake. We have lots of plans for this summer. But the third way that I connect with recipes is to create 21st century adaptations of things that I know how to make using only indigenous ingredients. I will dream up recipes and experiment with them in my own kitchen. I've made bison and butternut lasagna through that method. I've made an indigenous pad thai using zucchini noodles and maple vinegar, and just experiment with foods. that's something I was lucky. My mom let me do a lot growing up, and it's something that I do within my own platform now.
Your DigiKitchen mission is much more than just having a cooking show, obviously. You're concerned about health issues. You're concerned about the heritage and the history and the maintaining of a Native American way of life, really. And particularly in the time of COVID, COVID has hard hit the Native American community. And some of that maybe has to do with the healthy eating habits of the population. What's your thoughts on that?
I don't think I'm qualified to diagnose, treat any diseases on this. But I will say that, of course, the stronger our bodies are physically, the more emotional well-being we have, the better equipped we are to fight diseases in general. I think when we have a sense of place on the landscape, when we're taking care of our bodies and giving them the nutritional building blocks that they need, we're able to fight back against any type of disease. So of course there are traditional plant foods that people are using to treat and prevent viral diseases. And that's something that I don't focus a lot on within the work that I do. I think in a lot of cases, medicinal knowledge is very privileged, but I do try to give people the information about healthy, delicious foods. That said, there is a huge anecdotal evidence that I have heard communicated to me from folks across the country around Indigenous nations that are making efforts to eat less processed foods, avoid processed sugar, avoid wheat, flour, and dairy, and start to convert their diets back to Indigenous diets. Though they're using modern kitchens and they're able to purchase from Native suppliers rather than go out and harvest everything. And the words that I'm hearing from folks about how much better their bodies are feeling when consuming traditional Native foods are amazing. It's funny because I didn't realize how many people were in this community of trying to restore these Indigenous food systems until I got involved with the work. And now that I'm connecting with folks, it's amazing and eye-opening and inspiring to hear the stories of people that have changed the ways that they're eating, not just for themselves, but for their families, and have really made big differences in the way that they're feeling, but also in how they connect with their landscape and how they relate to the world around them. They see the world as full of gifts and able to take care of them and their families. And of course, by that reciprocity and by that principle, are recognizing their responsibility to take care of where their food comes from as well.
Could you share one of those stories with us?
Yeah, I actually spoke to someone on the Blood Reserve very recently that's up in Canada, but of course, just across the border from my home in Babb. And he talked to me about how he's been working really hard to avoid a lot of Western foods, is what he called them. And he's noticed how much better he feels, how much more energy he has. He's an elder that I spoke to gather information about traditional plant foods, but also a recipe as well. And in the Zoom call I had with him, there were bottles and bottles of harvested plants that had been dried and preserved. And he was talking about all of these plants. And so as he was showing me things, he'd reach behind him and he'd grab a bottle and he'd show me and he'd say, you know, this is dried, but if you put it in water, it will rehydrate. It's really beneficial with these vitamins, these minerals, but it adds a lot of flavor. And he would just show me all of these things. And we were talking about the plants that he has access to up on Blood Reserve and the plants that I have access to closer to the mountains down here on Blackfeet, and just talking about trading some of the plants that we each have access to. And in that way, we also recognized that we were kind of restoring traditional trade routes. You know, that international border that crossed our homelands has reduced our ability to gather some of our traditional foods, but we also can fight back with Zoom.
Is this a phenomenon that's happening with other Indigenous populations around the world?
This is very common among Indigenous peoples around the world. Colonial governments have targeted Indigenous food systems because the ability of people to feed themselves is damaging to colonialism. You know, we recognize that as long as people can feed ourselves, we can choose our paths with a number of other things. We can't choose whether we eat or not. And so if you remove our ability to feed ourselves, it forces us into labor and obligations and agreements that we would not otherwise be burdened with. And so that, of course, has been used across the United States and across Canada, but you see that in similar ways among Kanaka Maoli people in Hawaii, of course, Maori people in New Zealand, across Aboriginal nations within Australia, and across many, many other communities around the world. There has been restrictions placed on our movement and restrictions placed on our traditional land management practices, many in the name of controlling our food systems. So part of restoring those connections and restoring our well-being and our health is to recover those food systems. And you see it taking place in a variety of ways, but you also see this as a recognition of 21st century Indigenous wisdom and restoration. We're not looking at decolonizing so much as re-indigenizing. You know, we're not trying to move backwards. This is forward movement, and it's a healing in our communities, but it's part of moving forward and improving our lives.
We are speaking with Mariah Gladstone, founder of IndigiKitchen. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by Montana Rail Links, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers and partners. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. So, Mariah, you grew up in Montana, then you went off to Columbia University in New York City. How do you compare life in New York to the life in Montana?
You know, it's funny. When I went to college, I was 17 when I graduated high school and moved to New York City, and of course had to navigate an entirely new set of rules and dynamics and changes within the way that I was able to access everything. And of course, really started recognizing this massive shift within food systems. Of course, New York City is the place where you're supposed to be able to get anything. And I remember things that I wanted that I was not able to get access to was bison, which for some reason I can buy bison burger in a Walmart in Montana, but there are no Walmarts in New York City. And it was very hard to find bison. One time I was sick and I just wanted chicken and wild rice soup, and I couldn't find any wild rice. So I went to a whole bunch of different grocery stores walking around, because of course I was all on foot. And I couldn't find wild rice, and every type of thing that was wild rice was some weird version that had a couple grains of wild rice mixed in with like a bag of white rice. And I was frustrated by that. And I was also just frustrated by my ability to access cheese bagels, which felt weird in the bagel capital of the world. But I definitely started thinking about food access at that point. And then of course, coming home and being back in Montana, and I remember just wanting to have wild game meat in my dorm room as comfort food, things that I was raised on and things that I was trying to access. And I packed up a ton of wild game meat from my mom's house to take back to my dorm room at Columbia. And I had to fly with it, of course. And so it was in my carry-on bag, because I was like, if my luggage gets lost, I don't want this wild game to thaw out and end up packed in all my clothes. So I had tons of clothes wrapped around wild game meat so that it wouldn't thaw out while I was on the plane, and I could get it back to my dorm room and put it in my freezer there. It was funny just trying to think of those things that were comfort food to me and how to feed myself. Of course, in a very expensive city to live, but also just wanting to have the foods that I grew up on have foods that I know would nourish me and that I knew were harvested also sustainably, that my cousins had hunted. And definitely at that point where I started thinking more about food access.
As a kid growing up in New York City and now living in Montana, I'm the one who longs for a pastrami sandwich or a thin slice of pizza that you can pick off the street. And they're not so easy to find in Montana. So I've had the opposite experience. But let me ask you this. Is Indigic Kitchen able to sustain itself as a business? I know you're involved in lots of organizations and you serve on boards, but is this focal point for your life going to be able to sustain itself as a business for you?
Yeah, of course. When I founded Indigic Kitchen, I was still working different full-time jobs and taking vacation days to go speak at conferences, making videos, of course, on the weekends when I had time. But it was actually after an AmeriCorps term, finishing up helping the city of Whitefish write their climate action plan and doing work through that. It was as that was coming to an end that I realized that I had a full-time job on my hands with Indigic Kitchen. I was, you know, trying to balance distance working for that AmeriCorps job while also traveling around and doing a ton of contract work for folks and making videos and teaching cooking classes. And I took that big jump of leaving a full-time steady paycheck, as little as AmeriCorps is, and jumping to this full-time business. And it's weird, I still don't think of myself as an entrepreneur, but I do run my business full-time, and it's enabled me to do something that no one ever told me I could do growing up. But I get to teach people how to use Indigenous foods. I get to teach cooking classes now from my house and rebuild native food systems. I get to partner with Indigenous producers and help them market their products. I get to work with folks doing SNAP education and help make sure that tribal communities are getting education in how to use, you know, subsidized assistance programs to buy Indigenous foods, how to restore Indigenous practices within our agricultural systems to ensure not only healthy foods, but healthy soil, healthy land, healthy water. And all of this is done through this business model. It's about sustainability. It's about this restoration of food systems. And somehow it's a real job, even though people don't always believe me when I say what I do for a living.
Is it fair to say that your audience is primarily for Indigenous people?
Well, Indigenous people are definitely the folks that I had in mind when I started Indigic Kitchen. I have a lot of non-Native viewers as well. I connect with folks in different organizations that are interested in Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous foods because they recognize them as beneficial to their bodies, but also to the environment. And so I've been lucky enough to do corporate gigs and teach classes to groups at Intel and McKinsey and Company and these large firms that are just interested in Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous foods and people that want to be eating less processed foods in their diet and incorporating local foods. So it's definitely Indigenous knowledge, and it started out being just for the benefit of Indigenous people, but anyone can benefit from this information.
You're 5 years into this journey now. What have you learned from it?
The lessons that I've learned from Indigic Kitchen and from teaching Indigenous foods are learn new things every day. And sometimes that is just more information about foods themselves, just from other Native cooks, Native chefs working within the industry, just learning more about the incredible diversity of our plants and animals and preservation methods has been amazing. But also that, like I suspected, Native people are really interested in eating healthy. They're really interested in their traditional food systems. That's something that I had guessed. Otherwise, I never would have launched Indigic Kitchen. But it's really amazing because from the very first video I put out, there was a huge response. People were tagging their family members. People were sending me pictures of the recipes that they were making off of my site. And I could see that people were using this information. I have regularly heard from people that they never knew how to use this squash or whatever it might be. And now it's become a regular part of their diet. They're able to incorporate those things into their meals. Their kids love them. And it's information that's being used. And so as long as I hear that, it gives me motivation to continue doing the work that I do.
You went to school for environmental engineering and environmental science. Now you're doing multimedia. You're running a business. Do you have a mentor that you go to help you with that aspect of the work you're doing?
I am lucky that I've been part of a couple of really great fellowship programs that have given me some great tools for navigating some of that stuff. But it's also been trial and error with a lot of things, bookkeeping and navigating tedious business forms. I'm lucky that have a great executive coach through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Center for Creative Leadership and the fellowship that I'm wrapping up with them. But I'm also part of the MIT Indigenous Communities Fellowship, and they provide a lot of information about funding mechanisms and business structure and things that I didn't even know that I didn't know. So it's all been really helpful in this learning process to understand all of that a lot more, because the more successful I can be with this, the more people I can reach, and the more we can work on helping Indigenous communities.
It seems clear that fellowships have played an important role in your educational process. What advice do you give for students that are looking to fellowships as a way to enhance their educational experience and their practical experience? What's the advice that you would share?
So I have found fellowships through a number of different sources, but of course, trying to connect with a lot of these folks that are looking at social impacts and recognizing foundations or organizations that are interested in helping those change makers. And it was actually through the Center for Native American Youth and my time as a champion for change through them that I first became acquainted with fellowships in general and this idea of mentorship and partnering with organizations that can help you and provide you with advocacy training and all of these resources to help you navigate really challenging systems. And it was then through connections like that. Of course, for me, it's been connections with Indigenous organizations, being looped in on way too many weird email lists that have helped me a lot. But subscribing to those things has brought a lot of benefit. And of course, now with so much accessibility of digital learning resources, you can connect with so much information that's out there. Even if you don't pursue formal fellowships, you're able to find a lot of free trainings. You're able to find a lot of webinars and benefits and be able to engage within this networking space, albeit digitally. And when you figure out how to successfully do that, you open up a lot of doorways and start figuring out the questions that you need to ask to be successful. And I think that's what a lot of these resources and organizations have done for me.
You mentioned that you have communicated with other Indigenous chefs. In what type of forums has that happened?
So I've been really fortunate to connect with a lot of different Native chefs around Indian country, both through the digital forum as well as in the before time when things were in person. So I've been lucky. I've been able to do cooking demonstrations with folks like Sean Sherman of the Sioux Chef organization. I'm doing presentations with Crystal Wapipa from Wapipa's Kitchen. We're speaking at the Southern Plains Tribal Health Conference in another month. So doing lots of great work. Brian Yazzie is a Navajo chef based in the Twin Cities area. I reach out to him for specifically Navajo cooking instructions, but there's tons and tons of Native chefs out there doing amazing work. And I love watching their journeys, but also being able to network with them and share in this resource of Indigenous knowledge and cultural revitalization that we all have in mind.
Last question for you, Mariah. What does the future look like for you?
I hope to continue to expand my platform and the work that I'm able to do, not just with recipes and foods in that way, but also expanding into Indigenous agricultural restoration projects, you know, looking at the sustainable methods of polyculture planting, of no-till that we've been practicing on Indigenous land management, which actually ties very closely into my master's research and how Indigenous people have cared and maintained for our spaces, but then use this tool I have to restore knowledge to continue to expand all of those other additional spheres of knowledge that connect with our food systems.
Mariah, it's been great talking with you today, and I commend you on your ambitious and well thought out journey. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hogue and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time for more essential business lessons from Can Do. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.